Hello everybody, welcome to the second in our occasional series, Suvadra Seasonal. And here we are in the autumn with Suvadra. In the summer we heard from about a memorable summer in his life in 1969 that took him in a 10-year arc through to ordination to the Western Buddhist Order, now the Triratna Buddhist Order. But we thought we'd come together this time to discuss more of Suvadra's present life as the world turns to the cooler. Mm. And here we are all these years later, 2014.
How many years later?
45. 45 years since that first, first podcast. A long time to be in love, anyway, with a life.
Mm. My new love, Buddhism, the Dharma.
Your lifelong love.
Mm. Yes. You know, sometimes I say to people that in all the years since I became a Buddhist, since I had that first decision, I've never, ever, not for one moment, regretted it. I've never thought I took a wrong step. I certainly took small steps at the beginning. But yes, I don't think I've ever regretted making that decision to be a Buddhist and making the decision to join the Triratna Buddhist Order. Hmm. Triratna Buddhist Order is certainly not the ideal order that I would like it to be, but I'm committed to try and make it like that.
Hmm. Now, we may touch in passing on different phases of your life, your order life, but right now it'd be good to hear, in a way, what you're up to.
Hmm.
Some people, obviously, who are involved with our community will know you of old in different phases, but you're entering quite a different phase now, aren't you, where you're now here at Adisthana.
I don't know if I'm entering it. I think I'm in it now.
You're in it.
I'm in a new phase. Perhaps I should say, first of all, that, you know, I had been working in India with Triratna from 1985 through to 2010, and that I lived in India most of the time between 1994 and 2010, so about 16 years. And then I came back to the UK. So quite a number of people who might be listening to this may be my old and dear friends from India.
Hmm.
So in some ways, I should maybe say a little bit about having come back to the UK and what it's been like for me. It was a very sudden transition. A whole number of circumstances came together, and I found myself back in the UK, and I was offered a place to stay both with Subhuti at his little property, Maes Gwyn, as it's called, in Wales, and I was offered by my dear friend Moksha Priya to come and stay at his place, Clogwyn Cellog, or Elephant Mountain Hermitage, as he's nicknamed it, in North Wales. Well, Moksha is much, much more cunning than Subhuti. Subhuti's wise, but actually Moksha is pretty cunning. So he said, you know, why don't you come to my place first? So he thought if he got me to his place first, probably he managed to catch me. And he did. I went and I stayed with Moksha when I came back from India. It was a dreadful, dreadful winter. We're talking about the autumns, but actually I came back in the winter. It was that winter where there was incredible snow lying for weeks and months. The temperature's below zero in Wales in a thick stone house. Oh, I thought I was going to die.
Oh, after awful. India.
It was awful. I hadn't had such cold. And I was in a room which, although I had the heating on, it still felt cold. Bitterly cold. But I loved being with Moksha Priya, and we managed to get across and visit Subhuti at times. And I thought, well, yeah, why not do that? Stay with Moksha Priya and we can visit Subhuti. And I was staying in Moksha Priya's guest room, and after a few months I thought, well, this is not very good because he's only got two rooms, his own bedroom and his guest room. And now that I'm staying in his guest room, he can't have any guests. So what to do? He thought, if we built a little cabin, then you could have your own space and we'd have an extra place. So the idea sort of unfolded, and eventually, to cut a long story short, we built a cabin. And it's a log cabin with one room and a mezzanine sleeping platform, a wood fire and small shower and toilet, little kitchen area, everything I need. First time I've ever owned a little property in my life. And I lived in that for about 2 years with Moksha Priya in the house just next door. and got on with my life there, studying and doing my meditation practice. And that's mainly really what I did.
Sounds quite idyllic in a way. Sounds like you were quite content with that.
Yeah, very content. And certainly idyllic. Very lonely. At the Elephant Mountain Hermitage, there's just one neighbour, well, a couple down the track who have a small farm, and off another track, another neighbour who just happened to live with Bhante in 1950 in the Dharmadaya Vihara in Kalimpong.
Good Lord.
Yes. Incredibly small body. If you look up facing Mount Kachinchunga, look up Leslie Turner, you'll see the young man, Leslie Turner, who visited Bhante. Now he's around about 90 years old, the same age as Bhante. And we just found out just last year. So apart from those neighbours, it's actually very, very quiet. Mm. All you hear is sheep.
Now, you weren't formally on solitary retreat, so presumably you were also going other places to visit or having guests come up every so often? Or?
Very few guests. Paramartha came up to visit with a friend. Visantra and Vijayamala came up. We had some meditation practice together. But very few other friends of mine. Mokshapriya's friends came up regularly. His friend Prevardita, Moksha Jyoti, Vibhuti, and himself, Mokshapriya. So the four of them were very, you know, regularly together. And they just accepted me in. Of course, I'd known them all in previous years, but I hadn't had much contact with them, really. Apart from Moksha Jyoti, he came along to the Buddhist Centre in Manchester at the same time as Mokshapriya did, so I got to know them both at the same time.
It's still very much a Manchester connection.
Yes, yes. But apart from those occasions when they visited, actually, it was like an extended retreat, if not entirely solitary. And I did treat it as a bit like a retreat. And I was thinking to try and make it like a 3-year retreat. So the first two were more meditative and studying. And I was hoping that the third one would be going into the area of writing maybe a bit more. But things didn't quite work out that way. Bhante Sangharakshita had not been very well. I'd gone to visit him, but he didn't even feel well enough to see me, which I didn't think he would feel well enough to see me, but I thought he might appreciate that I've actually come across to Birmingham to visit him. So after a few days, I went back to Wales again. But then Bhante moved to Adishtana in March or April of that year. So that's last year. And he wasn't at all well. Wasn't a well man at all. Very, very weak and exhausted, not sleeping, and being looked after by Paramartha, Buddhadasa and Ashwajit, and they were overstretched. Paramartha having to work as well for his living. And one day Subhuti said, why don't you go across to Adhisthana and see if you could just, you know, help a little bit by supporting Paramartha, because he's finding it quite a strain. So I thought, yeah, I could do that. But I also knew, I think I know what's going to happen here. And so I went and I got on very well. And Paramartha and I, we've known each other for quite a while. And we get on very well together. And certainly Bhante appreciated that I managed to visit and help. But he didn't look well at all. And I said to Paramartha, well, look, you know, why don't I come back every month just for a week and just, you know, be around and help and support you and so on. And so I did that. But the next time I came, Bhante was a bit better. And the month afterward, Bhante was looking even better. And slowly he seemed to just climb back out of the hell that he'd been in. It really was a quite torturous period for him. And then round about, I think, October of that year, so I'd been coming, I think, for 6 months, Bhante expressed his wish that he would like to see me living at Adhisthana. And he said that's all he would say. He wouldn't say he wanted me to do it or not, but he said he would like to see me, just expressing his emotion. So I replied, well, I certainly would like to come, and certainly would like to come and help you, but I would have to think about it and consider that. And he said, well, I hear that you would like to come, but are not committing yourself, and that you would like to consider it. And I knew that's exactly where it had been leading. And I had a couple of other things to do, which took a month and a bit. And then in November of last year, 2013, December, sorry, 2013, I came down to stay here. And I said to Bente that I would like to come down, but I thought I could only do it 3 weeks in the month, and the other week I would have to keep my base in Wales because I was continuing some medical treatment there, and I didn't want to break that. So I didn't complete a third year in my little cabin of having a semi-solitary retreat.
And now here you are in a very different landscape to that Welsh one.
Very different. This is the heart of England, it seems.
Unspoiled. The last bit of unspoiled England, almost.
Is it?
Somebody was telling me that it's one of the rare places in England where if you stand out in the road outside here, you can't hear a motorway or a major artery.
Mm.
It's true, actually. It's real silence at night.
Yes, yes. And it's just so green, and the countryside is all arable, and you go up little gentle hills and you can look over the landscape. It's beautiful, beautiful. I loved the mountains of Wales, and I didn't mind the solitude, but I'm enjoying the landscape here, and it's certainly not a solitary place being at Adishtana. It's a retreat centre, and people come in and leave week by week, which is great. I see lots of my old friends, at least lots of my old friends from the West. Sometimes also some of my friends from India come and visit Adishtana.
You're enjoying it here then?
Very much enjoying it, yes. There's two parts to the enjoyment. One is, you know, just helping in his life. So I sit with him, I stay in his flat overnight at times, just being a person there that he can call on if he needs. I have breakfast with him. And sometimes, although he's not able, doesn't have the energy to talk very much, it's just delightful to know that the man who gave the Dharma as I have been practicing it, I can give him back something.
Hmm.
It's very little, I think, in some ways, doesn't measure up. But I'm glad I can give it.
And it's what he needs, isn't it?
And it's what he needs. Other times he's able to talk much more, and it's delightful to just have his keen eye, his penetrating eye, cast upon the various things that you're talking about.
Hmm. So you're caring for Bante some of the time. I'm assuming you're, in a way, developing your life in other areas here, your practice life, your friendships, etc. You were telling me earlier that you're a largely retired public preceptor.
Yes.
Now, the public preceptors, if you're listening and don't know, are the people responsible for ordination into the Theravada Buddhist order. And you're now at least in three-quarter retirement, shall we say? You still attend college meetings, you still...
Yes, but I'm not doing any more precepting. I've introduced either as a public preceptor or as a private preceptor about 150 people into Triratna, which is much, much more than, you know, we would think of nowadays.
Mm.
But myself and Subhuti, we were an interim type of preceptor between Bante, who did all the ordinations, and the newer group of preceptors who've begun to take on the responsibilities. So Subhuti and I both have quite a number of people we've ordained, and perhaps too many. I certainly have too many.
Mm. But you are still involved in the aspect of being a public preceptor where the college are at least developing a sense of, well, being the guardians of the order in other ways, not just ordination. Anyway, caring for Bante's legacy and the development of that legacy. And
the preceptor college very much sees that's their function, to, you know, guard the legacy. They're not the only ones, I think, guarding the legacy, but certainly we take it as one of our primary duties. And it's not easy to sort of guard that legacy because the legacy itself is not static. It's always changing and developing.
It's a living Dharma?
It's a living Dharma, yes. So, you know, it's a bit like, you know, at one point you're looking after a baby, and the next point you're looking after a youngster and a teenager, and it grows. So there's quite a demand there.
Well, that's in relation to your in a way, public life as an order member. I wonder if you could say something a little about your practice these days as a, as it were, private order member, your kind of personal emphases and explorations and studies, etc. at the moment.
I think quite a number of the order members, and maybe some of the mitres too, who know me, think I'm a sort of a Tibetan Buddhist practitioner. I'm sort of one of the Tibetan Buddhist practitioners within Sri Ratna. I'm not, actually. I don't relate to myself as being a Tibetan Buddhist practitioner. Although the practice that I'm involved in mostly at the moment, and probably will be for future years, does come through the Tibetan tradition. And the practice is called the Chod practice. It's usually spelled C-H-O-D. And the literal meaning of it is cutting. And the practice is about cutting the mara of ego clinging. Of course, having come through a Tibetan system, or come through not a Tibetan system, but a tantric system, it's enacted upon a tantric stage. So it's got a very sort of colourful, dramatic, ritual dimension to it. There's singing, so something for the voice. There's visualisation, something for the mind. And there's playing of a drum and a bell, and the picking up of a thigh-bone trumpet and blowing it. So there's something for body, speech and mind. Again, you know, that sort of harks back to what I said on my previous interview, that ritual and devotion are a very important part of my life. And that when I discovered the Chö practice, it was rather like discovering something that was very, very full and rich, that helped me express a lot of things that had been building and bubbling and developing in my life.
And would you say this is a practice that requires quite a bit of preparation and quite a bit of experience of both the Dharma and of meditation itself?
I think so, yes. Traditionally, that wouldn't be the case. Traditionally, you know, you would probably learn it in a monastery by joining the other monks, rattling your drum and ringing your bell and so on. And then you wouldn't find out about it for some years afterwards. But you'd have learned the ritual form. But the actual meaning of it, you wouldn't come to later. But nowadays, of course, when you pick up any book on Chö practice, the whole thing's there and you see it immediately. But I don't think it's something that's necessarily easy for beginners to do. Because one of the main emphases in the practice is to push you to face the demons that you carry with you. And that's not easy.
Yeah, you need a very good base.
You need a good base of integration and positivity. In other words, you know, you have to have a good base of practice in mindfulness and metta bhavana. And people struggle to develop those, you know, even for years. And I didn't take up this particular Chö practice until I was at least 35 years in the Dharma.
And taking that level of care says something, doesn't it? It's not a practice to be treated lightly or taken lightly.
No, it's not. And that is something that Sangharakshita said to me. I specifically went to him at one point and I said, I'd written to him, first of all, saying that I wish to take up this practice. I wanted to investigate it further. And what I thought would be valuable from it, I'd like to bring back into the order. When I went to see him, I said, I've written to you and I've said these things. I'm quite willing to accept a no. If you don't want me to do it, then, you know, just say, and I'll be happy with that. He said that it was one of the first times he really felt with anybody that he'd had the freedom to say no. And he knew that I could accept a no, and I'd be happy with a no. So I was thinking, yes, okay, so you're saying that. is it going to be a no or a yes? So he said, I'd be happy for you to take it up. And I trust that you'll take it up very seriously. It's not something to be played with. And I said, yes, I knew that very well. And I would keep him informed of how the whole process was going, and I would let him know what I thought could be brought into the order.
And that process is quite important, isn't it? It's not exotica, it's not the newness of a practice. It's something there's a real sense of connection to, but also in a context, in the context of the order and your ordination.
It was a bit strange when I took it up, because at the point at which I took up the practice or started investigating was back in 2005, and that's just the time when there began to be a re-looking at our system of practice within Sri Ratna, and a request by Bhante, Sangharakshita, that we focus mainly on Shakyamuni and Shakyamuni's tradition, especially as communicated in those early Pali texts and those meditations that have come down through some of the schools, mindfulness of breathing, metta bhavana, and so on, and that we didn't lean too much towards Tibetan Buddhism. Well, of course, people always take things a bit too literally when they hear Bhante saying this or that. And some people have thought, you know, well, Tibetan Buddhism is out, you know. It's not that Tibetan Buddhism is out, it's that we shouldn't lean too much towards it. And we certainly shouldn't accept any tradition, whether it's Tibetan or Zen or the Theravada tradition, we shouldn't accept it just on its own...
historical merits or something?
Yes, historical merits, that because it says this, that's the way it is. No, we have to look much more keenly than that. So I was in a slightly uncomfortable position that I wasn't quite sure how much I should let people know in a sort of more public manner that, well, here I am taking up a drum and a bell and a thigh-bone trumpet and chanting stuff in Tibetan words, when others were turning in another direction back towards Shakyamuni.
That's a very interesting facet of order life, isn't it? That not just a range, but actually a range that moves. Again, this thing of a moving, living Dharma community. But you're located in your practice, aren't you, with your teacher, with the man who ordained you, in that sense of having expressed permission from him. And also your fidelity to the context yourself.
Yeah.
Whatever is going on, sort of undulating through that context, you've got you've got a sort of real fidelity to that.
And Bhante himself, he knew of the practice. He'd never formally done the practice, but he knew of it. And he'd obviously thought about it, because on one of the very first occasions we talked about it, he said, of course, you know, it's rooted in Prajnaparamita. It's basically Prajnaparamita that you're involved with there. In other words, the concentration on trying to develop the perfections, especially the perfection of wisdom, which is in the Prajnaparamita tradition, wisdom of seeing all things, self and other, are empty. So
empty,
he said that.
Empty in what sense?
Well, empty of anything fixed, empty of any particular label that you can put, empty of any particular...
Essence
you can say. It's not an easy thing to put forward. That's why, in another way, it's not a beginner's practice. He also said something which was very interesting, which I'd begun to think as well. He said, well, basically, the Chö practice is the six-element practice enacted upon a tantric stage. And I'd done quite a lot of the six-element practice, where you reflect on earth, water, fire, air, space, and the element of human consciousness, that there's nothing fixed about them. The earth, water, fire, and air, you've borrowed from the world. They're not yours. You can't think of you being them. And in the meditation, in the reflection, you give up those elements. Well, that same thing you're doing in the Chö practice. You look at your body and you let it go. And consciousness element in the six-element practice, you ask yourself the question and you reflect in an open manner. What is the nature of your consciousness if it's not limited anymore by earth, water, fire, air, and is not associated with a particular space, a particular shape? Well, what will consciousness be like then? It'll be much more unlimited. But of course you do that and you're sort of a bit stuck, because you can hear yourself saying these questions, but you wait for the answer and it's like waiting for the echo of emptiness to come back, and it doesn't come. Well, it does come, but it's never what you think it is. In the Chö practice, your consciousness is no longer associated with your body, because you've let your body go, and you see that, you imagine, you enact that consciousness is released into something much wider, into a bodhisattva figure or a female Dakini type figure, which represents enlightenment. So you see it being associated with enlightenment. So it's very much the same sort of meditation practice, but it's more colourful, It's got song, it's even got dance. I forgot to tell you about the dance.
There's two aspects of it that, just listening to you evoke that quite beautifully there. One is, anyway, maybe to talk a little bit about the personal effect on you of taking up a practice in that very serious way. Mm-hmm. And that sense of commitment you've got where you're already saying, well, I'd imagine this is something I'll be doing going forward in my life. And also the relationship to teacher. So, you know, in their last podcast, 1978, you meet Sangha Akshita. Mm-hmm. And here you are all these years later, and that relationship is continuing to flower in this context, and is obviously quite a rich source for you of, well, empowerment almost is the word that empowers you to go forward with your practice life and, well, your whole life, in a way.
Yes. It's interesting you used that word empowerment there, because empowerment is the word that's used with Tibetan meditation practices, that there's no way forward without empowerment from the Lama. And that empowerment is seen in a particular way that, you know, he will sprinkle water and he'll donk you on the head with various ritual implements and so on, and then you've been deemed to have been empowered, and then you can do the practice. There's a few more steps apart from that. And I knew that if I was going to learn this practice, I would probably have to go outside our Buddhist order, outside our movement, and learn it from one of the lamas in the Tibetan tradition. And I knew I would have to ask Sangha Rakshita if that was permissible, if he would agree to that. And he did agree to that, yes. He knew that I would have to take initiation, empowerment, in the traditional sense. But from his point of view, I think it's more like a tactical, maybe not in tactics, strategic.
It's a skillful means.
A skillful means, that's what I mean, yes. I'd be receiving initiation as a skillful means so that I could learn the system and take into the order what elements I thought and others thought were important.
And that empowerment, in a way, in that specific context, is fully contextualised, isn't it, by your relationship to Sangha Rakshita as your teacher and to the order?
Well, for me, when he said, yes, you can do it, you can take up that practice, for me, that was the empowerment.
Hmm.
That was the initiation. He said, at ordination, which meditation practice would you like to do? And at ordination, I said, I would like to do the Amitabha practice. He said, the Buddha of love. So he recited the mantra three times, and then I considered that I was then, as it were, empowered to do that meditation practice. Since I've learned much more about our system, and I think even Sangha Rakshita himself has deepened his views on what goes on at the ordination ceremony, that within the ordination itself there's an element of initiation. Within going for refuge, there's an element of initiation. So, although I took it at the time that I was permitted to meditate upon Amitabha, later on I learned that actually all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are not multiple. There's one reality. And yes, it may manifest in different facets, like the Buddha of love, Amitabha, or the Buddha of light, Varochana, and so on, or the Bodhisattvas. So being initiated into one, actually, as far as I can see, is being initiated into them all.
I'm just remembering Sangha Rakshita in one of his lectures talking about initiation into a new life. It's almost as if the acorn of that initiation grows into a tree that's got many limbs and many branches, but it is one living, almost ecosystem of practice.
Yes, yes. There may be different branches on the tree, and even sort of different ecosystems within the branches, but actually it's all one tree. So, yes, I like your image there.
So before we finish, just maybe, it'd be good to hear a little bit about this, the sense of how does doing a practice, because even with the best will in the world, when one evokes these kinds of practices, it can sound quite exotic. In a way, it's quite foreign, as we say in Scotland. And but of course, that's not why you're engaging with it. And presumably, it's having an effect on your ordinary life.
Yes. Well, interesting you speak about the exotic element, because even within the Tibetan system, all the commentators on the practice speak about, you know, don't get carried away by the external thing because it looks exotic. They all say that. Even, you know, 100, 200, 300 years ago, commentators in the practice say that. The practice is not about singing in Tibetan. It's not about rattling a drum. Not about ringing a bell or blowing a thigh-bone trumpet. It's about facing the maras that you carry around with you and giving yourself up to all beings. So, you know, it's not an easy practice, and it's something that's not just limited to the cushion.
And I suppose I'm interested, again, in terms of quote-unquote ordinary life, for anybody who's practicing the Dharma, how you described that meditation there, you could say in a way that's the purpose of all serious meditation.
Yes.
This is a particular form, and presumably there are all sorts of aspects that one brings to that, temperament and personal preference and conditioning and karma and all these things. In a way, why do you think you're attracted to it, and what does it, as a particular form, what does it bring you in your kind of daily experience of living this life at Adisthana, caring for your teacher, you know, developing your relationships and friendships?
I think in the previous 10 years to taking up the practice, I was concentrating a lot more on two or three different elements within the Dharma. One was exploring much more the Bodhisattva ideal and doing that through recitation of a daily puja on the Bodhicitta. I was also exploring offering of the mandala, where you offer up everything that you imagine of value to not only the Buddhas, but to all beings. And I was also very taken with the mind training teachings which Subhuti started outlining round about the year 2000 when I was in India. So those three things together flowered at a particular point, and the Cho practice seemed to contain those particular elements to a very strong degree. Plus there's something else maybe temperamentally here that, you know, I tend to make a decision. Right, that's it, I'm Buddhist. And I've been a Buddhist for the rest of my life. Yes.
The cut.
The cut. In a way, that's it. Yes, you got it. I've decided this is it. I'm going to do it. And I face up to it. And I've got to face the consequences too. Well, the Cho practice helps you do that. But as you go on, of course, you're carrying with you all your past. You're carrying with you all your old habits, all your old, you know, thoughts and stories that you have in your life. And in the Tibetan system, in the system of Cho particularly, these would be seen as your maras. Now, in a way, it's not just maras. The word in the Tibetan system is ladri. Kla is God. Dre is demon. So it's not just maras in the sense of what's bad. It's actually what you interpret as being really, really good and really, really bad. So you get carried away when both those things come. Hopes and expectations on one side, fears and dreads on the other side. And you sort of build them up almost into, you know, figures that you carry around with you. And you relate to them, you talk with them in your own mind. Oh yes, if I did this, if I did that. And oh, if this happened and that happened. And all the time you're carrying yourself by this prapancha, this elaboration. You're carrying yourself further and further away, and you cut through it. You say, enough, stop. This is story, this is Mara, this is just a tantalising God figure that's carrying me away with myself.
Yeah.
Come back to what's important. What's important? Here and now. Being aware, what you're doing, why you're doing it, where you've come from.
And is there a sense of kindness explicitly in that as well? That sense of, it's not just a kind of cold, cutting awareness.
Yeah, right. I think that's very important to say that. Because when people think about the Cho practice, they think about this cutting element. So it's not a ruthless cutting. It's a definite cutting, but it's a cutting of what hinders you. And at the same time, there's the consideration of other beings, that you're not alone. You're in the same predicament as everybody else, who are also trying to free themselves from their own difficulties. One of the strongest elements in the practice is the enactment of the Bodhisattva ideal in terms of giving everything that you've got to your teachers, to your ideals, to all beings in the world. So although there's the visualization of the giving up of your body, and even it's a very graphic, definitely graphic, giving up of your body. It's not giving up of your body in an unkind way. It's using the resources of your material world to give to others. And you give them, you visualise giving them what they need. So you visualise if somebody needs a bed, you give them a bed. If they need a bridge, you give them a bridge. If they need a boat, you give them a boat. If they need food, need medicine and money, you imagine, you give them. If you could, you would do it. That's what you do in the meditation. And then when you leave the meditation, you don't leave the meditation.
Exactly.
Yeah? You take with you, okay, in my meditation I was visualising so-and-so is in a difficult situation. Okay, let's go out to that person. Let's do it. So you enact it. And that's, in a way, the Chö practice is put forward as being a 24-hour practice.
And that makes sense, doesn't it, in terms of it becomes the whole arena in which you're living, and,
yes,
and whatever hinders mindfulness, whatever hinders kindness,
yes,
gets cut through or seen through,
yes,
cut through.
It's the seeing that cuts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good. It struck me, actually, just as you were talking there, that since it's an autumnal theme, it's spiritual death and the autumn of things. It's quite a potent image, and this practice in some ways has got that flavour. It's not the death of things in the sense of a winter death, is it? It's a...
Well, when you think of the trees, the trees shed their leaves in the autumn, don't they? What actually happens in a tree, and this is my biology coming out here, is that the vessels in the tree begin to close up. But to close up, they have to grow. They have to grow so that they cut the sap to the leaf, and then the leaf drops to the ground. And also, not just the leaf, but fruits drop to the ground too. So
a
new cycle begins. Not just a cutting that's a cold and dead cutting. It's a cutting by life, to give more life.
Wonderful way to end. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for these autumnal reflections.
Autumnal season.
I look forward. I hope you can come and do another one in the winter.
Absolutely. Perhaps in winter we can talk about Dorje Rinpoche, with whom you have a strong and historied connection.
Yes.
But for now, thanks to Suvajra for his seasonal, and we'll be back with more Buddhist Voices on the Buddhist Centre online. You can connect with us on SoundCloud. You can get the link for that on the homepage of the website, as well as a link to our podcast on iTunes. And we look forward to speaking to you again soon. Bye for now.